Shivaya Pratibodhi Tam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvam Anusantadhami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadveshini.
Verse 49. Bhagavad Gita 49.
Asakta buddhi sarvatra. Asakta buddhi sarvatra. Jitatma vigatasprahaha. Jitatma vigatasprahaha. Nashkaranya. Naishkaramya Siddhim Paramam Naishkaramya Siddhim Paramam Sanyasena Tikachati Sanyasena Tikachati Asakta Buddhihi Sarvatra Jitta Atma Vigatasprahaha Naishkaramya Siddhim Paramam Sanyasena Atigachati.
Now, this whole section now, we're moving into exactly how this knowledge is gained and its relationship to Karma Yoga. It starts out, Asakta Buddhihi, nominative singular, means the one whose buddhi, whose mind is asakta, not attached, free of attachment. Sakta, you know, asakta, if you say asaktoham, asangoham, sangha, asanga, it's the same. Asakta is the same, past passive participle. So the one whose mind is asakta is not attached, so asakta buddhihi. So asakta buddhihi means what? The one whose mind is not attached to raga dvesha. The mind is not attached to your raga dvesha. This is kind of a beautiful concept because often we think asakta buddhi, the mind is not attached to this thing or that thing, but actually you have to go on a level from that. The mind who's not attached to the raga dvesha, to your likes and dislikes. Remember the likes and dislikes, the passions. Really, I need this to be happy. I don't need this. I have to get rid of this to be happy. Those are the raga dvesha. What if the raga dveshas are not very important to me? It doesn't make so much difference whether I want this or I don't want that. That's not what's primary. What's primary in terms of the world is dharma. Dharma is trumps raga dvesha. For me, on an emotional level, on the level of my shraddha, on the level of my feelings, on the level of what's meaningful to me in life, it's not my raga dvesha. It's dharma. And the reason that it's dharma is because dharma is Ishwara. Dharma is not different from Ishwara. So if you think of the whole manifestation of the creation, this whole creation is Virat, as Ishwara. The creation is the creation is held together on both a feeling level, a subtle level, and on a physical level by dharma, all of the laws of dharma. Right? And I want to be in harmony with those laws. It's almost like understanding, if you understand this creation as Ishwara, as a being, right, who is a moral being, who is a dharmic being. We say Ishwara is dharma. What does it mean? It means that all of the laws, if you are in harmony with all of the laws of dharma, you are in harmony with Ishwara, because Ishwara's whole structure is dharma. You know? And your structure also needs to be dharma. It means your whole value system, the choices that you make, the way that you see the world, the way that you operate in the world, if that is also run by the same dharma
by the same set of laws, then you find yourself totally in harmony with Ishwara. In fact, you're almost invisible. You are Ishwara. The jiva, in the end, for the one who has jnanam, really surrenders to Ishwara. Because like a cell in the body, this body, mind, sense organs, is a cell in Ishwara's body. You're a cell in the total. There's nothing about you that is apart from Ishwara. Just like there's nothing in the cell that's apart from the body, the whole thing, the whole behavior of the cell, everything, the operation of the cell, the mission of the cell, you know, the karma, the prarabdha karma of the cell, all of it is part and parcel of the whole body. It's not separate. It's made of the same and integrated in the same series of laws. It is that. And so say the cell in the body has no resistance to that. Right? Then its life is as it should be. It's in total harmony with its prarabdha karma. The prarabdha karma is Ishwara. Why we even say prarabdha karma is because as a little cell in the body, as a jiva within this infinite creation, the direct immediate experience of Ishwara is limited. It is Ishwara. It's not separate from Ishwara. It is Ishwara, but it's limited by the range of your sense perception and even by the range of your logical extension. Your experience of Ishwara is limited in terms of your relationship to the form, to the total form. Your experience of Ishwara as the self is not different. It's only one. This being that I am is Ishwara. The Atman, the conscious being that I am, is Brahman. It's not part of Brahman. It is Brahman. Your being is free of time and space, so it can't be divided. To think, well, I'm a little part of Brahman. No, you're a little part of Ishwara, this body, mind, sense organs, but you're not. The Atma is not a little part of Brahman because there's no time and space from the standpoint of you. And so you cannot be divided. You can't be partial. You are just exactly what you are, and what you are, the being that you are, is the being which is Ishwara. You can't, is the being which is Brahman, the very self of Ishwara. So there, it's not a cell to the body. It's the one conscious being that is Ishwara, that is the Satyam, the very being from whom this whole manifest creation arises, is sustained, and resolves. When it manifests, or in Brahman, with Maya manifests in this form of Ishwara, right? Or the, you just say really to be very specific, when we're talking about Brahman, just Brahman, as the one non-dual self, we're just talking about Satchidananda, the limitless conscious being, that's all. When we bring in Maya, which is mitya, right, which can't be anywhere else but Brahman, because there is nothing else but Brahman, right? Non-dual me, from my own standpoint, non-dual means there's not a second thing. There's no, just think of it like this. Where should we put Maya? Maybe we should put it over here in this space. Let's put all be me, the non-dual Brahman, and we'll put Maya over on this side of here. But there is no side. Let's put Brahman, let's put Maya in its own space. There is no space. Space, air, fire, water, earth come from Maya and go into unmanifest condition, just like your dream. Think of your dream, right? When you have a dream, the space comes with the dream. You know? And so now, if the dream resolves, where's the space? So where is there another place to put the Maya? There's no other place. And when you study the Maya, this Maya, this world, when you analyze it, when you do the vichara, when you analyze it, you can't find anything here, because anything that you say is a thing is actually infinitely divisible into many things, smaller and smaller and smaller things. And anything that you say as a thing actually comes into being and goes out of being. So any type of analysis of this creation makes it disappear. There's only one thing that doesn't disappear in the analysis of the creation, and that is what the creation actually is, which is conscious being. No matter how much you analyze this creation or break it into parts, and so you have infinite names within names within names, what remains steady in the midst of that analysis is conscious being. That's all. It never changes. It never modifies. It's always the presence in which any amount of analysis or any amount of dissection takes place. And that conscious being is Brahman. That conscious being is me. And that is the truth of this whole thing. You analyze, 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 take it apart, take it apart, take it apart. There's only one thing that remains, and it's there at the beginning of the dissection and at the end of the dissection. It doesn't move or change in any way. So that's Brahman, that's myself. And myself is the constant, the me, which is me. It's the constant in every experience I have, and there is no experience that's away from it. So even in this moment, as you're looking at this room, the constant here, which is itself free of any type of spatial, any type of space or time, doesn't apply to me, and yet, in the manifestation, say, of this room, there is nothing in this room that is way away from my being. What's away from my being? Nothing. What's away from my consciousness? Nothing. But if I look just at myself, I have no time and space. These words don't mean anything. You're just sitting with your own being. There is no time. There is no space. These words are inappropriate. They don't land on me. But this Maya that we experience has no other place to be. So we say this Maya is natural, beginningless to Brahman. Right? This manifestation is natural. This is Brahman's manifestation. It's mitya. It has no independent being apart from Brahman. It is a manifestation of Brahman. And this manifestation is held together by infinite series of laws, all kinds of order, all different orders, psychological orders, physiological orders, astronomical orders, all kinds of orders. But all of the sciences, it's all orders. But there are moral orders. What brings about happiness or well-being or a sense of relaxation? That's order also. Yeah. What brings about your sense of well-being and your sense what causes pain? Over centuries and centuries and centuries, all of the religions of the world and the spiritual disciplines of the world have figured these things out. You line them all, I do this for my students in Eastern theories. You line like Buddhism and Sankhya and yoga, you know, and Vedanta and any type of the mystical traditions. They tell you these things, these behaviors cause pain. You know, the Ten Commandments. These behaviors cause pain.
Don't close that window.
We can try. Yeah. These behaviors cause pain. Why? Because they're a law. So say, as you start understanding these laws are bigger and bigger than you. These laws contain you. And so as you start to understand these laws, let me just go on. The asakta buddhi means your buddhi is free of attachment, really to raga dvesha. The attachment is to dharma. Dharma comes first. Your raga dvesha don't mean that much. How can they not mean that much? Even without knowledge, even without self-knowledge, in your experience, you begin to realize that really Dharma gives a much greater happiness, a longer-lasting happiness than your raga dvesha. If your raga dvesha are in line with Dharma, it's really no problem. But if the raga dvesha are in line with dharma, and the primary commitment is to gaining that object for your happiness, then, even though they're in line with dharma, they cause pain. Right? Because it's not possible to control the world. It's not possible to fulfill all of your desires. So in the end, even the raga dvesha that are in line with dharma, which are really, there's nothing wrong with them, as long as you are not terribly attached to the result. You know? But in the end, as you start to mature, you give up on the raga dvesha, you don't care that much. Because dharma is enough. The dharma is enough to give you that wholeness. And the raga dvesha are completely secondary. So the dharma gives you a much longer lasting shanti and creates a mind that's really available for this knowledge. So the asakta buddhi is the one that can have raga dvesha with not a tremendous commitment to the fulfillment of your raga dvesha. It's nice, but it's okay if it doesn't happen. The commitment is to dharma. And the commitment to dharma is really the commitment to Ishvara. So the karma yoga buddhi, the one who has that karma yoga buddhi, is the one who does all actions in service of Ishvara. But how do you operationalize that? What does it really mean? It means that I do what is there to be done. What is the appropriate thing to be done in this situation? And what is the appropriate thing at the top of the pyramid for dharma? Is really ahimsa. Let me behave in such a way that I'm not harming, causing any harm to myself or others. What does that mean? Let me treat others as I would treat myself, and don't ever treat others as I wouldn't treat myself. And that's true for all beings. It's not just human beings. The Dharma, the Hindu Dharma, the Vedic Dharma, is toward all beings. They don't say, do anything that you want with the animals. You have dominion over the animals. And there's actually that statement that's been terribly maligned. You have dominion over the animals. You know, do what you want with them. But, you know, don't kill human beings. But in the Vedas, that's not the spirit of it at all. Dharma is toward all beings. Non-injury is toward all beings. And for your heart to be really whole and free, that gentleness has to pervade everything inside and out. And that's another thing that sometimes we don't realize in terms of dharma, in terms of that kindness, in terms of the basic, I say the basic dharma is abhayam, non-injury. Abhayam is freedom from fear. And I think this is key for antakarna shuddhi. Means let no being be afraid of me. Means let me to be, let no being be afraid of me. Well, they will be afraid of me if I'm afraid of them. So the first part of abhayam is let me not be afraid of any being. Why am I afraid of beings? I'm pushing them away in one way or another because in some way they seem to be taking away my happiness. So your presence, because whoever you are, you take away my happiness, so go away, I'm afraid of you, because as you approach me, I may become unhappy somehow. You know, we don't really see the subtlety of this. But actually that abhayam means let me not be afraid of any being. And then let no being be afraid of me. They can't not be afraid of me if I have that type of bother myself, pushing them away, pushing people away. And why would you do that? Well, you do it because you're afraid. You're afraid they're going to take away your happiness. That's what it is. It's very simple. And we think that way because we've projected our happiness out onto the world or out onto situations, and I have to have the world be like this or like that in order for me to be happy. Which means I have to push away all of the things and all of the people and all of the situations that might take away that happiness. Because actually that happiness that I'm talking about is my own being. And so you're feeling a loss of yourself. People are threatening the loss of yourself by threatening your happiness. And that's not acceptable. And so that abhaya vow, the sannyasa, is the final word, really, in terms of dharma. And so that becomes also your primary sadhana. your primary understanding of Dharma, your primary understanding of Ishwara, that is the surrender of the jiva to Ishwara. When the jiva doesn't surrender to the Atma, the jiva is the Atma. The Atma that I am is Ishwara. There's no surrender there. There's just reality. There's the truth of it. I am. The self that I am is the self that I am. I am whole and complete. I can't surrender my Atma into Brahman because my Atma, myself, is Brahman. Right? So there's no surrender there. If at the removal of Ajnanam, I realize that my being is Brahman. But what about this body, mind, sense organs? I don't realize that this body, mind, sense organs is Ishwara. It is Ishwara as being part and parcel of Ishwara, just like the wave is the ocean. It's not separate from the ocean. But the wave is limited and totally contained by all of the laws of the ocean. It's no way separate from the laws of the ocean. And like that, this body, mind, sense organs is in no way separate. Not in any way, on any level, from the Ishwara Upadhi. And so the Ishwara Upadhi is Dharma. That's what holds the whole thing together. And we experience varying degrees of discomfort and pain when we're pushing up against that Dharma. Even in physically, when your body is in pain, what do? You try to figure out, you know, what is wrong? What is wrong? What can I do to heal this? The pain itself is a signal. There's something needs to be done here. Something where I'm doing something wrong that is hurting me physically. What can I do to take care of that? Emotional pain is the same thing. I realize something is going on. You know, something is going on that needs to be taken care of, that needs some sort of adjustment, that needs some sort of healing. But pain is not for nothing. It's helpful. It's trying to help you. You know, we don't like it because it's painful. But it's actually trying to help you. It's giving you a message that you need to do something now. You need to take care of this. You know. And so, even when we say, A dharma, when we're has to do with kind of the moral order when we're talking about a dharma. When we're moving against what we should be doing, you know, that a dharma, it's what we call a dharma, it creates pain. And then that pain you need to cure. So a dharma also, it just means that we're going off track. Bhagavan says, boom, boom, boom. Look. You know, come back. Come back. And so that becomes that dharma and the message of a dharma becomes our sadhana. Our whole life is about dharma. Our whole life is about Ishwara. When there's emotional pain or pain that is cause is there in the unconscious because of traumas that were what happened when we were little or when we're mean to somebody in the world now, even if it's excited by some trauma from a young age, nevertheless we suffer. Say for instance I have a childhood trauma, I have to work on that childhood trauma, and I have to do that really by reparenting. I have to reparent. I have to give it the love and the support that it didn't get in the first place. Otherwise, how can it grow? How can it rejoin my psyche? We have to re-bring it up, and you can only do that by giving it what it should have had, what it needed to have, you know, which basically is love and respect. It's not just love, it's, oh, I love my stupid little child, you know. No. It's love and honor and respect, you know, so that they have everything they need to grow as a strong little person. When that isn't there, there's all kinds of defenses and hurts and pains and acting out, all kinds of things that happen as that little one struggling, you know, to make things right. And so that can play out here in the world, right? It gets triggered here in the world. And then, but say, it's this little one inside is getting triggered. And in the world, you behave violently or mean. So you're mean to somebody or hurtful to somebody, even though it's caused almost invariably by childhood problems that cause you to be that way. But when you're that way in the world, even though it was caused by childhood problems, then that person feels bad and you feel bad. Right? You both suffer. You're angry at somebody, that person gets the result, the brunt of that anger, but you're the carrier of the anger. You hate somebody, that person feels hated, but you're living with the hate. Right? All of these things are painful. They're not what we want to be. They're not how we're supposed to be. We feel like there's some virus inside that we need to get rid of. Right? And so there's a whole learning curve to deciding none of this is worth it. None of this type of acting out is worth it. No type of cruelty, no type of pushing away, no type of hurting, no type of meanness is worth it, because I am the one who is going to be the carrier of all those things. I suffer more than anybody else. So we realize, no, let me be that, have that asakta buddhihi. Let my commitment be to dharma, not to raga dvesha. Let any slip from that just be my sadhana. It's not like we're perfect as we grow, but everything that goes away from dharma is sadhana. That's the thing that I bring to my attention and I work on, and I visualize and see what would be a better way to be in that situation. And this is true. What's so amazing about this is true inside and outside. Not just outside, inside. How do you treat your mind? Are you a friend? Do you have that ahimsa, you know, that dharma toward your mind or toward your complexes or toward your own body? You know, people have complexes about their body or how they look. All kinds of complexes, inner ones, those we don't know that we have to have the same relationship with. Ahimsa, non-injury, welcoming, allowing it to be what it is, allowing your body to be what it is, to be free to be what it is, allowing, you know, your complexes to be what they are, and you come in as somebody who can help, you know, allowing your anger to be what it is, but you come in to help to resolve the problem that is causing that. That's kindness. Say you have a little child that's acting out all the time and angry and mean and beating up and bullying everybody. And you meet that child with that same attitude. You little bully, I'm going to bully you, you know. You think you can get away with this type of behavior? So you end up just mirroring the little bully, you know. You can't be like that. You can discipline, but not giving the same bullying, the same bullying attitude. You can be very, very strict, but underneath is kindness. If underneath your strictness is acting out, you know, is anger or rage, then that strictness is not going to work. It's just going to be resisted, because what the person feels is your rage. If they feel love underneath, then they can respect your strictness. So all of these things, these are the things that we have to live with. We have to live by all of this. So it starts with this asakta buddhihi, means what is important to me is dharma, not raga dvesha. And that asakta buddhihi is sarvatra, toward everything. Sarva means all. Sarvatra, that tra affix means location. Sarvatra means everywhere. The asakta buddhi is everywhere. There's no exception. Like, well, I have the asakta buddhi for most things, but not this. But you know what? Everyone in the world has an asakta buddhi for most things. There's just a few things. There's a few things that get us. So with that asakta buddhi, then the jitatma. Jitta means conquered. Atma, not here does it mean Brahman or the self, it means the mind. Brahman is not going to be conquered. Atma is not going to be conquered. It's already exactly what it is. You can't do anything about it. It's the jitatma, means your mind is conquered. Means that because really raga dveshas are not ruling your mind, you know, then your mind can behave. What are your values? What's the dharma? If the dharma is stronger than the raga dvesha, then your mind is in line. And so it becomes a mind that is conquered. When the raga dveshas rule, it's very hard to be a jitatma, one whose mind is conquered. When dharma rules and raga dvesha are secondary, then the mind becomes becomes one is conquered. Conquered means it'll do what you say. It doesn't drag you. You're able to control it. You're the master of your mind. And with that, you become a vigata spriha. Vigata spriha means, say you have some control of your mind, but underneath is a lot of longing. Spriha means attachment. Like, you know, vigata means free of that longing. You've given something up. You've given up certain behaviors, for instance. You know, or certain desires. You've given up certain desires because they're not good for you. But that's all you think about. You know, you have longing for those things. And you've given them up because you're trying to do the right thing, but all of the time you're thinking about it and longing. So vigata spriha is the absence of that longing. You know? Say you give up your raga dveshas. I'm giving up these raga dveshas. But then all you think about is your raga dveshas. What about when you don't have a value for the raga dvesha? You've given them up, but you have no desire for them, so you don't even feel like you've given them up. That's what has to happen. You're not really giving them up. It really doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. In fact, you don't want it. It doesn't matter, and you don't want it to matter. Because if it matters, you know, if your life, your well-being is dependent upon things going this way or that way, you're in so much jeopardy, you know, because you can't control the way things go, only to a certain degree. But you don't have that type of control of all of the beings, that they all behave in just the way that you think they should behave. That's a terrible situation to be in. You know, that's why Swamiji would always say, it took me years and years and years to learn it in an embodied way. He used to always say, give people their space. Let people be. Let people be out there. They have a right to be. You know, if they're mad at you or jealous of you or they hate you for this world, leave them alone. Let them work it out. It doesn't have much to do with you. Give everybody their space. Let them be. You know, that's to learn that is a huge thing. At least for me, it was a huge thing. Allow everybody to be as they are. You know, and if you can help, help. And if you can't help, you can't help. Then stay out of the way. Right? If you can be helpful, helpful. That's simple. But we tend to take people inside, you know. Like if somebody's bad vibing you or angry at you or hating you or said the wrong thing or whatever, they're inside there. It's like you've swallowed them. And now they're living there with you. So they've gone away, and here you are. With them inside. They can be on the other side of the world and they're inside of you. You know? And so it's a wonderful thing really to learn. To learn means to have that value. Let them be. Let them alone. Just let them alone. Let them be as they are and let them work out their problems, and if you can help, help. You know? I love that. It gives you so much freedom, you know. And it gives the other person freedom too, you know. Like I can be with you, I can allow you to be in the room. Say a person hates you or they're jealous of you. I don't think this is an easy thing, actually. I think it takes a lot of maturity, at least for me. It did to get to a place where if somebody is hating you or hostile to you or dislikes you or is jealous of you or all these difficult emotions to have to receive from somebody, you know, if you can have that abhayam in a real way, be a sadhana for a while, but where really it's there, they can be here. And I'm fine if they're here. Let them work on it. I don't have to take that on, you know. And I don't have to push them away. I noticed this, especially, you know, because I teach classes in school, so I'm always getting a different group of students. Sometimes there'll be 20, 30 students, sometimes there'll be 9, 10. There's always a different group, there's always a different constellation. And sometimes the constellation of the group there is very harmonious. And you say, oh, this is really a nice group, there's no tension in the group. Sometimes you get in a group, it can be a small group or a large group, where there's a one or two people that can be very, very difficult in the group. Right? They can be cantankerous or accusing or angry or talking all of the time. You know? And other students are starting to wriggle. And I know that as a teacher I have to stop this because they're going on and on and on and on. And they can't control themselves. And all of these type of dynamics are going on in that room. And so every one of us in that group has to learn how to accommodate this person, because this person is part of this group. They're part of it. They paid $3,000 for this course, right? They're a part of the group. And so you have to learn to allow them to be part of the group. See what I mean? In a workplace, it's like that too. If you have, once in a while, you have this constellation that everybody is just in harmony with each other and everybody gets along and you can really enjoy that. But you have to be able to enjoy when that constellation is not there. You know, when there's something difficult going on. You can imagine at the ashram when you're taking a 3-year course and there are 60 people, and Swamiji, of course, and the small staff, and 60 people all living in a small space together for 3 years. They're taking all their classes together, they're eating together, they're doing their karma yoga together, they're sharing the bathrooms, they're all living in a small space together for 3 years. For the first 6 months, it's fine. It's like a honeymoon and everybody's so happy to be there. But as time goes on, it's not always that easy. You know? It can be, you know, their agreements are pushing on each other in one way or another. It's just natural. It's normal. But you can't leave. And so it's a tremendous exercise. It's really an amazing exercise to be in that type of a cauldron for a long period of time, you know, and you learn how to let people, they have a right to be. They have as much right to exist and to have their reactions and their emotions and whatever they're going through as everyone else, every one of us, you know. And so in life it's like that. And you become, for you to be somebody who allows everyone to be, then you at least are not a problem. You're no longer a problem because you're allowing people to be, and then people have safety. At least in your presence, people have safety. So that's something that, and you have safety. Because not only do you allow other people to be, you allow yourself to be also. And when your mind is having problems, you are a friend. And you allow that poor little mind that's having problems and hurts and everything, you allow it to be, and you're there to help. You see what I mean? Abhayam. So all of that, this vigata spriha, these asakta buddhi, sarvatra jitatma, and vigata spriha, they're just talking about the mind that comes naturally with karma yoga. This is a karma yoga mind. This is what this is antakarana shuddhi for a mind that now has to gain knowledge. So what he's saying here is that the person who is like this, that person, adhigacchati, he gains the naishkarmya siddhim paramam, that he accomplishes that siddhi, that accomplishment of becoming actionless, naishkarmya, free from all action, which is the supreme, that supreme state, paramam, paramam, naishkarmya siddhim. He gains that through now sannyasa. Through sannyasa means through knowledge. Tir sannyasa just means knowledge. There is nothing that's naishkarmya, free from action, the state of being free from action, other than the Atma. There's only one thing that's free of action. You as a human being cannot become free of action. Your breathing is an action. You're grasping, you're walking, you're talking. You're sleeping, you're snoring, you're blinking your eyes. All of these are actions. Your body is in constant motion, constant action. You have to feed, you have to eat yourself. You have to eat. You know, there's so many things that you just have to do, even taking care of the body. So there's continual action going on. There's only one thing that is free from action, and that's your being, that's the Atma. So it's through this sannyasa, which is that complete renunciation of everything. Renunciation of everything means what? It's not this. It's allowing Ishwar to be. Your prayer becomes, if you have a prayer, I want what you want. Oh Bhagavan, I want what you want. That's it. I want what you want. This body, mind, sense, organs is yours. Whatever, this is the infinite intelligence. I want that. I don't want anything else. Why would you want anything else when you are the Ananda itself? Right. So let Bhagavan be. I give Bhagavan space. Give Bhagavan his own space. And in giving Bhagavan his own space, you disappear. You are Bhagavan. Part and parcel, you are Bhagavan. So that becomes a joy. I want what you want. Because if I want what you want, everything works. There's no problem. But to be able to say that, I have to know, I have to myself be Ananda. So I can say, I want what you want, because actually I know you can't take my Ananda away from me, because the Ananda that I am is the Ananda that you are, and it's changeless, it's not subject to time. So nothing can be done about it. So I can just let you be. I can let you be as you are. And this body, mind, sense, organs belongs to you. So I'll let you take care of it. Let me just do moment to moment what needs to be done. Why? Because the Ananda that I am does not exist in the mithya. The mithya exists in the Ananda. Very different. The Ananda doesn't exist in the mithya. The mithya exists in the Ananda. And so let me just be with my own being, be in that Ananda, and let Ishwara be. So that old Bhagavan, I want what you want, is the freedom, complete freedom. Because that's, I want what you want means I already have it. Every moment I already have that. So the jiva srishti goes away. And if the jiva srishti is there, I just bring it back, or let it be if it's not causing any problems, because it's something that the mind can do. But if it's causing problems, I just bring it home. Causing problems with going into some crazy things, just bring it home. It's much nicer to be here.
I was just one more minute. I wanted to tell you about something I was noticing. I was sitting out with Tibby today. And what I realized is Tibby is always in Ishwar Srishti, not Jiva Srishti. Your animals are in the present with what is happening, always. Yeah. They're always here, responding to what is. Yeah. There's none of this getting lost, all of this. Always here. And I've been noticing that when I'm sitting with Tibbs. She's Ishwara. Yeah. They don't have the problems of this type of self-reflection going through all of this stuff. You know, they have tremendous capacities, sensitivity, empathy, skills that go way beyond things that we can even imagine doing. You know, but their mind is free. Their mind is Ishwara and Ishwara Srishti. It's not that, so I was realizing, it's not that different than when my mind is just in Ishwara Srishti. I'm just present to what is. There really isn't a problem. I'm just present to what is. The Jiva Srishti creates so many problems. And so that's where a lot of the suffering is in the Jiva Srishti. And so what you want to do is always just bring that Jiva Srishti back to the present. Say, what is happening right here now? Let's be here now in the present and do the things that are to be done now. Yeah. Just like animals. Get back to your animal nature. Be in the present. And then use your buddhi constructively in the present. Then we're human. We have certain positive things, certain skills that animals don't have. They have many, many things that we don't have. But this particular human animal has something too. Maybe we have a buddhi. But let's use that buddhi in Ishwara Srishti. Then it becomes so clean and so beautiful. So, that's good enough. Om swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishah go brahmanebhyah shubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshati parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yamksho barahitah Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschid dukkha bhag bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotir gamaya Mechorma amatangamaya Om Purnamadav Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha. Hari Om.
Is the relationship of Dharma and Maya? Dharma is...
Nothing's outside of Maya, except Brahman as the... So in all dharma, even knowledge and ignorance, self-knowledge,
All of that is within Maya. Even though with self-knowledge, it's pointing to Brahman, which is the Satyam, and it can do that because you are that, and it's self-evident. But the mind is in Maya, the buddhi is in Maya, Dharma is in Maya, the Ishwara Upadhi is Maya. It's all mitya. But here's mitya within mitya, the jiva mitya, it was in Ishwara mitya, you know. But all of it is the Atma, all of it is the self, is in truth. Yeah.
So this, after this talk, it's a strong reminder of how far I have to go, because especially the people who I let in some way, or, you know, and it's especially people who are like really mean and they yell and they're really nasty and it's directed towards me and intended to make me feel bad. I just have a real hard time.
It's very challenging.
I just want to be away from them. And by the way, that's not what was happening before. I just thought that the loudness of it.
Oh, no, I know. I wanted it shut too, but I'm having this...
need the air.
I need the air. Yeah, otherwise that was the only reason. I would have definitely shut everything.
Okay.
It's just that... I have these little allergies.
Hmm. Anyway, so... Yeah, they're...
It's hard, yeah.
People, especially.
You know, it's kind of like... kind of one thing I've learned over the years is that some of these things, they take a commitment and a practice. And you have to actually work on it and practice the very thing. Yeah, and then you get it. It's not like knowledge. Knowledge of yourself is already completely present, it's perfect as it is. And so knowledge is enough. But there's certain conditionings of the mind, there's an emotional lag time in the mind. And so to take care of some of these things, you have to make a commitment to work on it in a proper way. That's why we say you make, yatna means effort. You make certain efforts. For antakarna shuddhi, you make efforts, and it's basically all attitude. But those attitudes take an effort sometimes to even bring the attitude forward. So we say not yatna, prayatna. It has to be the proper effort. Like, for instance, some of these meditations that we're doing and we've been working on, those are prayatna. Those are proper efforts. They've stood the test of time. They actually work. You know, if you work on them, they work. But then you have to do it. It's not like shravana. Shravana, you just have to be there and listen, and you get it, you understand, because yourself is there. You know, and then whatever questions are there, you ask those questions, but it's not doing, it's knowing, it's understanding. But working with your mind is a little different. It requires effort. And then you have to have a value for it, and a lot of things can get in the way of that value. Like one very common one is somebody's a total jerk and misbehaving and all of this kind of stuff, which is true. They're being jerky and they're misbehaving and doing the wrong things and saying mean things to you and all of this, you know. It's going to be a part of you that doesn't want to let that go. They deserve to be flattened.
No, and I get easily triggered by certain things. And then I'm gone.
Yeah.
And I wonder where to draw the line between, well, like I recently, there's someone who became a part of a group that I'm involved in, and, you know, I could have said, no, I don't want this person in, but I thought, oh, it might be a good practice for me. And now I'm like totally regretting it, and I want to leave that particular situation, because there's one person and I just get triggered, and it's more of a negative than a positive. And I'm wondering, you know, how do you? Well, we've talked about this before.
Yeah.
I know you've said like in here, like if you get, you can just leave, go for a walk or something, or go into the other room for a while. You know, and
well,
but then you're not working on it. You know, that's what I'm.
Well, I've got...
How much you put yourself in pain to...
Well, I think that you should not put yourself in pain, because the universe will do that to you enough. So I wouldn't purposely create bad situations for you, because you'll have plenty of your own that you're not creating.
So I don't really believe in that, but I know that the life itself will give you challenging situations. It's just part of the karma. And then some of those situations take time. You know, and I remember I've worked at the CIS for many years now, like 20-something years. And at one period there was one colleague that was really difficult. And I just thought, I just do not want to be here. I just don't want to live this way. I don't want to deal with it, you know. But of course I would have had to leave my job, you know, which I didn't want to do either. But I wanted to leave just because of this difficult person. It was really hard on me. Made it difficult for me to handle it. So I said to Swamiji, you know, I'm not going to do this anymore. I told him about it. I said, it's just, I'm leaving and I want to leave. And he just said, no. Yeah. He said, I said, what? And he said, when everything's fine and you're happy with everybody, then you can go. Mm. Happy with everybody means they're not a problem for you. Mm. Then you can go. Don't go. Don't run away from your life. Mm. And actually, in the Bhagavad Gita, this is exactly what Krishna tells to Arjuna. No, you can't. This is your dharma to be here in this battlefield. And yes, it's very difficult and horrible, but this is your dharma, and you have to stay here and do it. You know, when it's over, you know, when this is all over, then we can see. But no, I want to go to the forest now. Mm-hmm. I want to go and just study this knowledge and go to the forest. I don't want to do this. It's a horrible situation. But he was a Kshatriya, and it is his dharma to uphold dharma. That's what the Kshatriya's dharma is to uphold dharma. And the dharma was being terribly threatened. And so as a Kshatriya and as the king of the Pandavas, or prince of the Pandavas, it was his duty to uphold that dharma. You know? And he wanted to take on the dharma of a sannyasi. We just had that verse. We just had that verse, remember, saying the taking on another's dharma is, you know, doing your own dharma, even inappropriately, improperly, is much better than doing another's dharma well. Because it's not your karma. It's not your prarabdha. You're trying to jump out of your prarabdha to lead somebody else's life, and that doesn't go well. Because with your prarabdha, everything's settled. Everything's settled for your life. You're in your life, and it's unfolding for you. It's all part of Ishvara. Now you have some free will, so you make a decision. No, Bhagavan, I don't want this. Where I don't want to be here where I belong. I want to be over in this person's life. Well, if you go over there into that person's life, there's not really any room for you over there. Right? That's not where your space is. You know? And so you don't fit in very well. Because that's not your karma. That's not your life. That's not your prarabdha. So if you try to do it, you'll get booted back here. You will. Yeah. And you actually want to come back. Because it's so uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. You can't wait to get back. It's very funny. Has anybody had that experience besides me? Yeah. I have. And then I really realized the prarabdha karma has walls. And they're kind of bouncy walls. You bounce up against that wall and you get pushed back, and you feel relief that you're getting pushed back because you've got too far away from your own dharma.
I know what you mean, but it seems like almost a little dangerous to think that way, because it seems like then you could think,
oh, there are all these things that I can't do because I should just do the things that come easily. And I think about people that like totally changed their life in one way or another, and it was their
karma
to do that,
yeah.
You know.
Like, no, it's an inner feeling.
Yeah.
It's not a feeling that you, I mean, your life, all of our lives, has some very challenging things, but they're your challenges. And they're your hardships, and they're your struggles. And so you don't feel that you're outside of your own karma. You're very much in your own karma, but it's hard and it's a struggle. And some things are easy, you know. But when you're outside of what's yours, you don't feel that way. It's not about how hard you're struggling or how much energy it takes to accomplish something. Your whole being is there and it wants to do that. But that's not true when you start getting outside of yourself. It's a different type of feeling. It's not the feeling of being up against a real challenge. Because that real challenge is your real challenge. So it's a subtle thing. I know what you're saying, that would be problematic, like, oh, let me just do the easy things that come along.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then that wouldn't be your dharma either. Then you would be feeling bad. Like you're missing out, that you're not doing what you're supposed to do. See what I mean?
Yeah. I have a question about these two like logical ways of looking at, I think it's Nitya about the comes into existence and goes out of existence,
yeah,
and then also the examining something,
oh, infinitely,
names and forms,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think like I understand them, but what I think I have a weakness in is what they're proving exactly.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. When we want to say that satyam is real, means it's satyam. That means that it actually has being, it actually has existence of its own, and it's not borrowed existence. Right? It has its own being, its own existence. Now, the first thing we have to do is say, so we say, yes, each one of these things has its own being. It is a thing, right? But then the next question is, well, what is this thing? What is it? And then you find out, well, it's not really a thing. It's a conglomerate of many things put together that we have a name for. So we say, this is a chair. But this chair is not a thing. It's a conglomerate of many things. So really, there is no such thing as a chair. There's just the nama, the name, for many things put together that we agree to call a chair. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So there's no chair thing here. So then say we say, well, let's take one part of the chair, and that can be a thing. Like say we take the cloth. Well, that's not a thing either. That's a name for threads that are woven together. So there's no real one thing there to say that this thing exists. There's a conglomerate of things. So then you take a thread. Just we'll take the thread itself. Is that a thing? You say, no, that's not a thing either, because that thread is divided into many threads, and then that works into molecules, and then that works into atoms, and then that works into quarks. And so on, we find that we can't find the thing, because everything that you say is a thing becomes a conglomerate of smaller things. And as long as the thing takes up space, it's divisible into smaller things. So to even find a thing, to say that this thing exists, is not possible. It gets into this infinite regress, right? Smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. So there's no thingness that can be established. Just as Swamiji will say, there's names within names within names. Like say I say, this is a chair, and then I say, well, this is a cloth. And then I say, this is made of cloth and metal and etc. And then I say, well, let's just take the cloth. Well, the cloth is made of, you know, threads and this and that and this and that. So just names within names of what? Really, in the end, it's just names within names of Brahman, because Brahman is what is actually there, right? All these things are infinitely divisible, but what is their substance? From the chairness down to quarks, the substance that's actually there is Brahman. Okay? So that's one, to just show the mityatva of this, because you can't find a thing.
So the question is, like, what exists?
What exists? What actually exists? This is all mitya, because you can't establish it of having, you can't even find the thing, let alone establish that the thing has any independent being. Then the other one is to look at this world that we experience in terms of time. And we see that everything that changes, any change, anything that changes, comes into being and goes out of being. That's the nature of change, birth and death. The birth of the prior condition and the death of the prior condition. The birth of the previous non-existence, right? And the death of the previous non-existence. So birth and death. Called previous non-existence and posterior non-existence. Right?
If there's no thing, then how can the second part be true, that things are not existent, go into existence, and come out of existence? The second category can't be discussed because there's no things.
But the things themselves have substance. Like, say, for instance, that's why we use, like, the clay pot example. So you have the thing in, this is a drishtant, it's an illustration. So say you have a clay ball, just a lump of clay. Now you make that into a pot. The pot has now come into existence. You make that pot into a plate. The plate has now come into existence. The reason that can happen is because there is actually something there. That which is actually there is what we call satyam. Right? But say you take the clay out of the lump, or take the clay out of the pot, or take the clay out of the plate. If you do that, there's nothing there. So what we call mithya doesn't exist. It has no independent being apart from what is actually there. So what we're showing by saying this prior and posterior non-existence of something, all that is meant to show is that being, the being that they're enjoying, does not depend on that form. Because there's a prior and posterior non-existence to the form. And so therefore, its existence must be dependent on something else other than the form. Because the form comes into existence and goes out of existence. But there, in the middle, there it is. Right? But if it was non-existent in the middle also, you wouldn't experience it. And so its existence is a dependent existence on something that doesn't come into existence and go out of existence. That's what the satyam is. So in the clay pot example, even though it's circumscribed because it's an example within duality, you see that the clay does not come into existence and go out of existence as all of these different nama-rupas take place. Right? They negate each other, but they don't negate the clay. And so here, as everything is going on, continually changing, coming into being, going out of being, coming into being, going out of being, everything. What is it coming into being and going out of being is the Atma, is being itself. Being itself is a noun that doesn't come into being, doesn't go out of being. That's the that's the satyam. You see?
Good.
Oh. You know what I'm talking about.
I think so.
Okay.
I'm not sure it answered my question or my statement.
Okay. Do you want me to try again?
No, I mean, maybe I'm just making a semantical nonsense, or where it doesn't need to be made. But in the you gave two what seemed to be two criteria. One is that you can't really get anything. So
yes,
when you negate,
everything
when you negate,
is
you
yeah.
negate things.
What?
But then in the second one, we're saying things are non-existent, come into existence.
It's looking at it from two different standpoints.
Okay.
Yeah. Two totally different prakriyas. They're totally different prakriyas, but they both negate.
Got it.
Yeah. They just negate in a different way.
They're mutually exclusive and explanatory power. Then. They don't,
yeah, they don't
need
related.
To refer to each other.
They don't, yeah, exactly. They don't need to refer to each other. They accomplish the same thing, but they accomplish it in a different way.
each is fully sufficient, you're just giving us more to grasp onto.
Exactly.
So those aren't definitions of metta, right?
No, the definition, there's two definitions of metta.
Yeah, that's what
Sutta said, dham and nirvachaniya means that which can't be categorized as described as satyam or as tucham, as being existent, never can't be negated in all three periods of time, or tucham, it doesn't exist at all. So mithya can't be described or categorized in either one of those two ways. So then what is it? Mithya is that which depends for its being on an adhishtana. The adhishtana is the satyam. Right? And the mithya is 100% dependent on that for its being. Like in the rope snake analogy, the snake is mithya. It can't be without the rope. It's totally dependent for its being. The pot is mithya. It totally depends on the clay. If I were to move the clay or remove the rope, it's not there. So that's the mithya. So this whole creation and everything within duality is mithya. It means it has no independent being of its own. It totally depends on being itself as a noun for its existence. The being, the Atma, is its being.
So these things you've been saying in the last few minutes, is it any really any different than saying everything is consciousness and consciousness is one?
No. But to understand that, you need satya mitya, because here's this duality. So how can this duality be there, and then you say there's one non-dual Atma? So it's just a prakriya for showing, because people will say, what do you mean there's only one non-dual Atma? What about all of this? There's going to be one non-dual Atma and then all of this duality. That's two. So to be able to show that this duality is only the one non-dual Atma, then you have to show how that's possible.
Okay. But I don't know. I don't know what I misunderstood. But I thought I heard you say tonight, like, Atma was a state.
No, you misunderstood.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
You said something like that.
What did I mean?
She did say something like that, right? Because states come and go.
I think you meant a reality. You mentioned...
Maybe it was a slip of the tongue. Because Atma's not a state.
Yeah, because you never...
States are mental states. I use like mental states. They come and go.
You might have been referring to the state of the Buddha being identified with the Atma.
Maybe.
You might have been talking about that.
I don't know.
Something said that could have been interpreted like that.
If I did, it was just some slip, because that was thought was not a state.
Yeah, I just thought it was this.
Yeah. Okay, let's call it a night.